In a time like none of us have experienced before, there's strength to be found in community institutions like Iowa Public Radio. I'm Executive Director Myrna Johnson, and I'm so proud of the thoughtful, informed coverage IPR brings you on the issues that matter. Listener funding is the power source that makes it all possible. Facts, understanding, insight, that's what you fund when you give to this station. Make your gift now at iowapublicradio.org, and thank you.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It happened on a normal day, a typical summer day. Claire Sponsler went upstairs to do some yoga, and she suffered from a brain aneurysm. She never recovered. Her husband, Jeff Porter, was shocked and heartbroken, but still alive. He had to keep breathing and figure out how to live again. Porter has written a memoir about that year after his wife Claire died, a year he spent grieving and grappling with how to live and how to remember. Both Jeff and Claire spent many years teaching in the English department at the University of Iowa. He now divides his time between Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and Tucson, Arizona, and he is on the line with me. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, hi, Charity. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today. And I would love it if you'd start us off with a little bit from the first chapter of your book.
Ready? Sure. Okay, this is chapter one. And we begin in the hospital. Here we go. You lie motionless as the respirator lifts your chest up and down. You've been here for 72 hours, and I haven't seen your eyes in 3 days, not since you collapsed. Blue eyes, I fix their color in my mind. Blue-gray, already I've begun the work of remembering. You seem so restful you could be sleeping, but you're not. This paradox is messing with my mind. Before you died, this is what I dreamt. In the dream, I can't take my eyes off yours, your closed eyes. Like Superman, I want to see through your eyelids, beneath the subcutaneous tissue. I want to see your blue eyes once more. Just a thin fold of skin, your eyelids seem unnaturally opaque and won't let me in. The dream nurse follows her routine, replacing IV bags and resetting devices. Other dream nurses stop by. Everything is procedural for them, especially dying. They observe the monitors, obsessed with your numbers. I'm watching, keeping an eye on your closed eyelids. Suddenly, they're open. It's a dream, but it seems so real. Your eyes open and they're not blue. What happened to your blue eyes? I think, alarmed. Your eyes are dark and their vitreous body is cloudy with black ink, as if these new eyes are still evolving. I'm shocked. Inky black eyes. The nurse says this is common. I say, no, it isn't. My wife has blue eyes. This isn't normal. My wife has turned into a black-eyed angel, I tell the dream nurse, who thinks I'm nutty. But why doesn't Claire recognize me? At first, you don't recognize me. Who are you? Your eyes say. But then maybe you do, I think. I'll never know, and I'll always remember those sublime, spooky eyes, eyes that hold all our pasts and futures. There you go, two paragraphs.
Yeah, Jeff Porter reading from Planet Claire, Sweet for Cello and Sad-Eyed Lovers, his memoir. And Jeff, I know this must be difficult to talk about. It must have been difficult to write about. When Claire suffered from that brain aneurysm, you were right there. You were just downstairs. You heard her fall. You ran upstairs to help her. And so although you couldn't save her, she did wind up on a ventilator in the ICU, and she lingered there while doctors were making sure that she was really gone. What was that time in the ICU like?
It's pretty unimaginably overwhelming, really. And I think that, you know, the book really began in those moments when I didn't really know what to do. I thought I might lose my mind also. And that's when I began talking to her, and much in the manner of these protagonists in a Pedro Almodovar film called Talk to Her. And it really did come to my mind, but what it really was kind of an act of desperation. What else does one do? And so I just began talking to Claire, and that's sort of how I kept reasonably sane and alive during those moments. But there, you know, it's something that's very hard for me to return to, even though I do so in the book. But it helps, though. In the book, it's equally an act of literary writing as much as it is sort of remembering kind of the horror of that particular moment. And so I think the effort to turn that into something that's a little more literary makes it kind of livable and survivable.
You, in just those two paragraphs that you read, you were having a dream. And in your memoir, there is a lot of surrealism. We'll dig into that a little bit more later on this hour as well. But I can imagine that the whole thing felt completely surreal. Was there comfort in that? Were you tempted to escape to some sort of non-reality?
You know, that's always a temptation. I mean, there are so many options when you're in that state of mind, and it's kind of an extremist state of mind. Things are completely abnormal. Everything is upside down. And so really, there are many, many options. And I think that, again, sort of the act of trying to compose something made it more surreal than nightmarish. I mean, it is, you're living a nightmare. I mean, there's no waking up from that nightmare. I mean, it just kind of continues with you. And I think the effort to sort of compose these thoughts for the page, and again, it was sort of composing them in a speakerly way in the very beginning, and that sort of subtly transitioned into composing for the written page. And I think the surrealism emerges there. And yes, that surrealism is kind of consoling. It's also kind of makes the whole experience a little more intelligible, even though it remains kind of incomprehensible and ultimately baffling. To this very day, I'm still absolutely baffled. But for a moment, when you're composing something for the page, it is temporarily intelligible, and that's just enough to get by.
That time when she was on the ventilator, laying there, you write a lot about that time where her body was warm to the touch. You could see her breathing. You knew that her heart was beating. You had a monitor there to tell you all those things, but you could also touch her and feel that she was warm and hold her hand. During that time, you were mostly alone. Did you struggle with even understanding that she was gone?
Yeah, of course. You know, I mean, you just don't want to let go. And everything is, you know, the doctors, I mean, even just the looks on their faces, the looks on the nurses' faces, they all, you know, have that look of pity. You know, it's sort of routine for them to be sympathetic. But the sense of pity, you know, that sense of pity, which is so more unsettling than anything else, and it, because it speaks, right, it speaks to you, you know what that means. And so they were speaking their kind of emotional language. The doctors are really, really grim and impatient. And then there are the monitors, and there are so many monitors in intensive care, and they all speak their own language. And you know, that particular language, because I don't know it very well, seemed to suggest that there were signs of life. And I was really holding on to that. And that was absurd. But I knew the moment was absurd. And all I could do was just sort of play my role as an absurd character who is just completely overwhelmed and baffled by the universe. And then just sort of have these moments of kind of, you know, pathetic speech, talking to my wife on the hospital bed.
Some of her family members also came to see her and to, I guess, to say goodbye. In having them come, did that change how you saw her, seeing her through their eyes?
You know, I couldn't see them through her eyes. I think there's one little paragraph in the book which talks about her brother and sister who finally came, and they were just appalled at how diminished Claire seemed to them in the hospital bed. And I couldn't see her through their eyes because I was somewhere else with her in that hospital room. I mean, I really wasn't in an ordinary reality, and that's where they were, and they could kind of see her objectively. I couldn't find my way to that ordinary reality, and I don't think I wanted to, because I think the situation would have been even more overwhelming had I been able to see her and think the way they did.
You ultimately had to make a decision to allow the ventilator to be turned off. How did you make that decision?
Yeah, well, I almost didn't. I was kind of in conflict with the doctors because I had all of these ambiguous signs on the monitors that suggested that there was an irregularity. There was some noise being produced inside of her brain. And I saw that as, wait a minute. You know, who knows? And legally and technically, they couldn't certify her death until the neurologist recognized a state of brain death in those signs. And there was one that kept, there was a squiggle that kept going on. And the presiding doctor was very, very impatient about that squiggle. And he said, no, that doesn't mean a thing. And of course, you know, I'm going, yes, it does mean something. And so I resisted to the very end. And I don't even know if I said, okay. I mean, I think I resisted until the very end. And the only thing that really kept me compliant with the doctors was the fact that Claire wanted to donate her organs. And I wanted to honor that that wish of hers. And so, you know, I did sort of comply at the end, but certainly wasn't kind of an agreement that, okay, you can have her now. I mean, I just sort of resisted and held out. I was being, you know, very, very unreasonable, but I was in that strange space, and it was the only way I could act. And I think in the book, I compare myself to a character in the Greek drama, you know, who resists yielding her brother to evil Creon, and so Antigone.
Right, which is a very apt metaphor because Claire was a classicist, and we'll learn more about her in just a moment. We're going to take a short break. I'm talking with Jeff Porter. He's the author of the memoir Planet Claire, Sweet for Cello and Sad-Eyed Lovers. It tells the story of the year after the death of his wife, Claire, and how he preserved her memory and is still preserving her memory and put the pieces of his own life back together. This is Talk of Iowa. Brilliant novels, groundbreaking nonfiction, evocative poetry, great books, and insightful conversations whenever you want them on the Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast. Pick the books that speak to you or read them all. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest this hour is Jeff Porter. He's the author of a new memoir. It's called Planet Claire, Sweet for Cello and Sad-Eyed Lovers. And it tells the story of the year after the death of his wife. She died suddenly at the age of 62 of a brain aneurysm, and she never recovered. As he put the pieces of his life back together and tried to preserve her memory, he wrote this book. And Jeff, in the book, we were just talking about that time in the intensive care unit with Claire. And in the book, you write as if you are writing in that room. Did you start writing during that time?
I guess so. You know, I mean, it wasn't a conscious decision in my mind at all. Again, it was sort of an act of desperation when I began speaking, talking to her. I really think that I was kind of anticipating the awful emptiness that happens when you lose someone so important, you know, and I began to try to fill in that space with kind of an imaginary presence. So I began talking to Claire. And so in that act of speech, you actually evoke a presence. And so out of desperation, I was evoking that presence, and I continued doing so. And then it became a much more literary presence as I continued to survive and go through the many phases of grief. So in the beginning, no, it wasn't a conscious decision, but you know, somewhere inside of my psyche, I needed to scream. I needed to produce language, words, sounds, and eventually all of these words and sounds, they needed to kind of take form, take shape in some way that was a little more meaningful.
You also write in the book a great deal about your history together and who Claire was, her work, her life before the two of you met. When did you start feeling like you needed to put as much as you could about Claire and who she was down on paper?
That's a good question. Not immediately. And immediately I was much more in the present moment of grieving and trying to observe how the world was changing in my eyes in this really unusual state of mind. And then the reminiscing began. I mean, I was first taking long walks. It begins with these long walks in which I pay attention to things I ordinarily don't pay attention to, and that surprised me that there could be that I could be in such a vastly different state of mind than I normally am, and that was a little shocking too, to realize how in a non-grief state how much I miss, how little I see. And so, you know, that was kind of Shakespearean. You're transformed in some way by this tragedy, and you see things you ordinarily don't see. And I was quite impressed by that. And I think it was after these long walks of realizing this that I began to kind of dig deeper into our memories. And the same thing sort of happened with Claire, you know, kind of finding Claire again in these memories. It not only created more of a symbolic body for this imaginary presence I was creating by writing in the second person, it also gave me an opportunity to sort of rethink what had happened through our 27 years together.
Well, and I realize that many people listening to this program right now probably knew Claire. A lot of people in Iowa City, of course, would have known her at least tangentially, or worked with her and loved her. For people who didn't know Claire, tell us a little bit about her.
Well, the book does that. You know, it's the I think it'll be an eye opener for her friends and for her colleagues, and even for family too, because Claire was very, very shy and very, very reserved. In fact, she was even reserved with me, and so I had to do quite a bit of probing in the book. I think later in the book, I uncover a trove of former letters. These include letters to boyfriends and very close friends. This is before Claire and I met. And so that was, you know, that was kind of eye-opening and made me realize that there was this other person. This sort of before Jeff, Claire.
Right. And those were probably things that you never would have seen if it had been her choice, probably.
No, absolutely not. And I'm sure that, you know, I'm sure that she's holding out for revenge at somewhere in the universe. And I, you know, I did feel like I was trespassing, but I do that. I mean, I part of my life has been kind of a documentary life. I've done documentary work, and I feel very much at home, you know, trespassing. I don't mind doing that. And so it's very easy for me to do, but I felt a certain kind of pleasurable guilt in doing so, knowing just how private she was. So, you know, that in this book, she's not so private anymore. I mean, she, you know, there's for instance, there's a good deal of attention to her hearing problem, and she kept that a secret, even from her closest friends. And her hearing problem was quite severe, and someone who liked to play a public role, for someone who liked to play a public role, it was really, really quite stressful. And I, you know, to this day, I wonder what kind of harm that did to her brain. all that stress.
Yeah. Well, she was a classicist. The two of you met in Washington, D.C. Tell me what you were both doing when you first encountered each other.
Well, our very first encounter was on an interview. She came to campus. It was in the winter. And so she wore this really, really heavy, long overcoat. I really liked her overcoat. And that's the first thing I noticed about Claire. She had this used overcoat on. And so this was, I had been teaching at George Washington for a year, and we needed a medievalist. And so Claire came campus for an interview, and she left her gigantic wool coat in my office. It was too big for her, and it was really very old. And I immediately liked her because I could see that she was something of a hippie. And that was true. I mean, we both came from that same world, and so there was that impression. And secondly is that she somehow tolerated me. I was quite the young, angry man at George Washington University, and it was kind of a shame because it was a nice place. I had really, really good colleagues, and I had no reason for being an angry young man, but I had just come from a job that had really provoked me and made me very uncomfortable in academic culture. And so I was taking it on George Washington people, which was pretty funny. And Claire could see right through me. And that impressed me quite a bit. She didn't buy my angry young man. Everyone else was afraid of me at that school. But Claire would laugh and roll her eyes, and she handled me quite nicely. And I think that was really what convinced me that she was the right woman.
If I do my math right, both of you were in your early 30s or around 30 years old when you met?
Yeah, we were in our mid-30s.
Okay. So you had both had a lot of independent experiences. You both brought a whole lot to that relationship. As you started navigating those early weeks, early months of dating, you share so much about Claire's history, but I get the sense that you guys did sort of a delicate dance around history, not necessarily wanting to share too much.
No, it's quite true. Claire being kind of congenitally private, and she wasn't going to reveal anything she didn't have to. She's very careful and very smart and also very, very, very clever. I was less clever and tended to reveal more. I mean, a memoirist never holds anything back. And even at, you know, even in those younger years, you know, I wasn't inclined to hold anything back. But being around Claire, I became cautious too. You know, I certainly had a sense of her reserve and that her reserve was strategic. And so I became a little more careful, and I think that became something of a dynamic between us. I mean, I still disclose much more about my past than Claire ever did. But after a while, you know, it didn't become all that pleasurable because Claire wasn't interested. She was truly uninterested in the past, which was a shock to me because she was a medievalist and
right.
a classicist.
She was interested in the deep past, but not the immediate past.
Not the immediate past, yeah. And so, yeah. We kind of played this game where we would withhold what I think a couple would ordinarily see as crucial, if not critical, information about one another. And so I have to be honest, it was a lot of fun kind of putting these things on the page for the first time.
You share a wonderful detail about when your relationship really got serious when you were in Washington, D.C., and that was when together you went to buy a television. Even though you were not living together, neither one of you really had room for this television, but you wanted to watch Twin Peaks. And you wanted to be able to see that together, so you went to buy this television. At the moment, I mean, I can't imagine that you thought of that moment the same way when it was happening as you do in retrospect.
No, not at all. In fact, it was really terrifying because I think up to that point, neither of us had been conventional consumers. You know, we just finished grad school, and you know, we were flannel and jean wearing kids who bought books and you went to movies, and that was it. You know, we didn't buy goods. I think together the only thing we had bought was a bottle of wine. And so we decided to, we heard so much about Twin Peaks and we were so interested in David Lynch that we went to a big box store. We'd never been to a big box store. And so we got lost.
Both on the way to the store and in the store?
Yes. It was so scary. I mean, the Beltway is huge and we're not used to kind of going out on the Beltway in Washington. And then being in Fred Meyer's, this gigantic box store, and I had no idea that there were so many different kinds of TVs. It really was as if we were from the outback, you know, coming to America as pioneers from some kind of primitive culture. And so that was, it was really, we were frightened by the experience. And also we knew down deep what this meant. Neither of us could say, hey, you know, this is working. What do you say we make a life of this? We couldn't do that. And again, it's partly because of we were being strategic. You know, we were both these academic types who were, painfully self-aware about where we were and what we were doing and with whom we were. And so we were just too careful. I mean, we were proofocked by the whole experience of being in academia. And so we had to kind of play this symbolic game where we really wanted to be together in a sort of serious and formal way. But the only way we could do this was buy a 35-inch RCA TV to watch Twin Peaks. But that was it.
I'm talking with Jeff Porter. His new memoir is Planet Claire, Suite for Cello and Sad-Eyed Lovers. And you had both also, of course, invested so much in your academic careers. So tying yourself to another person, I can imagine, maybe felt even extra scary. I think we all find that to be a little bit scary when we do it, if we do it. But you both had careers that you were pursuing that could take you many different directions. Was it difficult to decide to get married?
I think so, yes. You know, we came from a culture that was very skeptical about the whole idea of marriage as an institute and as a psychological commitment. You know, we grew up in the 60s, and so there was a lot of weight. And I think our family lives were good family lives. I had a really good family. Claire had a lovely family. But we were still, you know, very, very skeptical of our parents' marriage. You know, we saw flaws there. I saw flaws in the marriages of other relatives, and there really wasn't any good model. So it was easy for us to find fault with the whole idea. So we were pretty, pretty shy of the notion. And it took us a while to understand that we really loved and cared for each other. And so, you know, even when we did it at the justice of the peace, and we kind of downplayed the whole thing. Again, you know, I think the true marrying moment was when we sat down to watch the first episode, the pilot of Twin Peaks. I mean, that was it. I mean, we should have had rings. There should have been incense. There should have been some sort of presiding authority there.
An exchange of a log.
Yes.
Yeah. So how did you both wind up coming to the University of Iowa?
I didn't like Washington. I was very, and again, I think this was sort of a residual restlessness from my first job in Charleston, South Carolina, which was kind of sort of a scary place to be at the time. And I remained restless. I was very restless, far more than Claire. And so, you know, I sort of talked her into looking for work elsewhere. And so she found the job at Iowa, and then I came along, and then I eventually infiltrated the system myself. And there we were away from the BMW driving lawyers and lobbyists in Washington, and felt a lot better. Of course, Washington has changed sort of dramatically since then. But when we were there, it was a pretty one-dimensional place. And it certainly felt like a foreign planet for two hippies who were trying to find their way back to America.
So Iowa City felt more like home.
Yeah, it was, you know, it still is up until the point I left. It's, you know, it's a tranquil place, and it's just a terrific place to get work done.
It's a lot colder than Arizona, where you are
right
now.
Oh, geez, yeah, I do not feel guilty. I've put my time in. I grew up in Buffalo, so I put my time in.
All right, we are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Jeff Porter. He's just published a new memoir. It's called Planet Claire, Suite for Cello and Sad-Eyed Lovers. And it remembers his wife, Claire Sponsler, who died of a brain aneurysm suddenly back in 2016. He wrote this book about that first year after her death as he was preserving her memory and also putting back together the pieces of his life. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa.
If you love this podcast and IPR, you probably know that it's fueled by listener dollars. Hi, I'm Rick Brewer, a talk show producer at Iowa Public Radio. And part of my job is connecting with Iowans who have stories to tell. When you contribute to IPR, you help make that possible. Membership contributions make up 57% of IPR's budget. That's huge and amazing. So do your part to support the podcast and programs you enjoy. Go to iowapublicradio.org and tap the red donate button. Thank you.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest is Jeff Porter, and he spent many years teaching nonfiction in the English department at the University of Iowa. His wife, Claire Sponsler, also taught in the English department. She was department chair in the English department at the University of Iowa for many years. She died suddenly in 2016, and he's written a memoir about the year after her death. It's called Planet Claire, Suite for Cello and Sad-Eyed Lovers. And Jeff, you write so much about Claire's mind and how she thought. And that seems to be something that it was incredibly important to you to try to preserve, to try to put down on paper. Why is that so important?
I guess it's partly has to do with the fact that her brain kind of blew up. And so that was, you know, she's a remarkable woman for many things. But her brain was really, I always found it wonderful. And so, you know, the mind-boggling irony of the fact that such a good brain would blow up so quickly and abruptly. You know, in a person who was really, really perfectly healthy. And I remember that the hospital gave me a reading of her organs after they were borrowed or passed on to someone else in the autopsy report, and that everything was really, really healthy inside. She had nothing wrong with her. And so, I mean, she had a long life ahead of her. And so the shock of that unexpected death, and you know, and taking place in her brain, just I think that really had an effect on me, and I just kept sort of circling around that fact over it again in the book in many different ways. And one of them was to remind myself and readers that this was a beautiful brain, and that, you know, it had blown up well before its time. It should have been clicking much, much longer.
The fact that she was so healthy and took such good care of herself, and you mentioned those organ donations, and you had a really conflicted feeling about those organ donations. And I know for a lot of people who lose someone, it brings them incredible comfort to know that their organs at least are living on in someone else and helping someone else. How did you feel about that, and how has that evolved?
I'm not sure how it's evolved, but when I was writing the book, to put it euphemistically, I had mixed feelings about sharing Claire with other people. And even though I know, Claire would have been very, very satisfied if not happy that, her kidney and her liver were being used by good working Iowans who were in need of help. And so, in principle, I certainly understood that and kind of honored that. But I felt possessive. And even to this day, I still feel a little possessive and I wanted Claire for myself. But both literally and figuratively, I just wanted Claire for myself. I didn't want to really share. And then there is also, the gothic element in it all. I mean, I just had a hard time getting past how grotesque and gothic the idea of keeping Claire alive so that they could harvest her parts for someone else. I never that to me. I mean, I shouldn't have been so impressionable about that fact because I think probably few people are. Folks are going to be, as you say, they're going to be really, really deeply satisfied that they could recycle themselves or their loved ones for the benefit of others. But I had an un I took an unreasonable point of view, and to this day I still feel a little horrified by the gothic element.
Well, I think it's nice that you shared that as much as I believe in organ donation, and I hope that my organs can be of use to someone after I die. But so much of grief is not rational, and I think that it's powerful that you share that part of it. And I also think it's really beautiful the details you share. You write about Claire as an observer, and she took notes about everything, and she kept journals, and she wrote down all kinds of details that many people would never have thought to preserve about receipts and things that she ate for breakfast 30, years before she died, and things like that. But you obviously are an observer too, and to be able to write with such detail about someone you love, that feels like such a gift.
It's that's put nicely. Thank you. In a way, I felt like I owed Claire that because, but also there is this other element here. It's part of the wonderfully strange dynamic that we'll never understand that takes place between lovers and married people. Is she observed me all the time? I could see her. I'd catch her observing me, and I'm thinking, oh my God, what is she thinking now? What is she waiting for? And so, and Claire was just had a tremendously bright eye. She could see things, and she was much more observant than I ever was. So in a way, I was kind of returning the favor, but also I was kind of doing that in a vindictive way because she always watched me. I think she was waiting for me to kind of make a mistake because I'm sort of accident prone, and I'm also a little more baroque than she is. And so I'm more likely to make a spectacle or to become a spectacle. And so she kept her eye on that. And so, in a way, I was returning the favor, but also there's a little irony behind that.
Well, you clearly enjoy teasing each other, but also you were a little protective of yourself, and she was a little protective of herself from that teasing. In retrospect, obviously that was done with love and humor. Are there things you wish you'd said and done differently?
Oh, you always do that. You kind of spend, a portion of grieving always in kind of in re revising and editing your life together. I'm sure I would like to have done things differently, especially by the time I finished the book. I saw ourselves differently, and it would have been nice to have kind of knew this beforehand, but it's impossible. I mean, this is, I guess, part of the horror of losing someone is that you really don't know them until they're gone. And it's a cliche, but it's true. And if you write about them, you write about yourself, your lives together, then there's a lot more to be understood And now I have that understanding, and sure, I wouldn't mind kind of editing things.
Yeah, well, and you also, I don't know, as a reader, I was also thinking of it from Claire's perspective as well, and I'm sure that she would have rather had a different last conversation with you, not about cutting up fruit for breakfast, but about something else. This book takes some, as I mentioned earlier, some surreal turns. You have created a character for yourself called Space Boy, and you talk about him, traveling through the galaxy. It's almost sort of a dual reality or a split personality. Tell me about Space Boy and the role that he played for you as you were grieving.
Yeah, Space Boy was very important, and it was kind of... It was a difficult turn in the book because it seemed so silly. And, you know, and this is a book that had a lot of, more so in its earlier stages, had a lot of gravity. And then Space Boy is this sort of teenage character who is very adolescent and who is produced by a kind of an adolescent turn in prose. So I felt like I needed him, and I know that I had a couple of early readers, good friends and colleagues from the nonfiction program, who looked at the text and they weren't convinced about Space Boy, and so there was a little bit of pressure to sort of cut the crap, and I couldn't let go of Space Boy, so I figured I just had to somehow make his role more compelling and more believable. So I really needed him. I think the book needed him for the lightness he brings. Italo Calvino, who also died early in his, I think, mid-60s from a brain aneurysm, wrote about the importance of lightness as one of the qualities of writing, as especially of fiction. And I saw Space Boy as providing this necessary lightness for the book. I didn't want the book to be all melancholic. And so I divided that, the task of melancholy and non-melancholy between these two characters. I, the narrator, the me narrator, would carry the burden of being sad and melancholy, but then Space Boy would do the unthinkable, and that is to fly off into space and to look for Claire in his little sneaker-sized spacecraft. So, and psychologically, he's sort of the split self trope that is, I think, it's not necessarily typical of grief memoirs, but certainly an important condition in memoirs to have space for another part of the self that doesn't fit in with what's going on. And then for the writing itself, Space Boy became very, very important because I was getting bored of my own melancholic eloquence after a while. I mean, I could write these beautiful melancholy sentences, especially on long walks, and I became tired and restless with those, and I needed to find a way out. And really, Space Boy was a way out so that I could create a slightly crazier prose style that I felt the book required.
I didn't know Claire, but having read the book, I feel like I know her a little bit. It feels like it's just a really beautiful tribute to her, but also it feels like you have preserved some essential elements of who she was. I'm sure that this book has been read already by a lot of people who knew and loved her. What are people saying? How are people responding?
I still haven't heard back. I've gotten a few emails from friends, and they say that it's a really lovely tribute to about your life together. I haven't heard back from family, from Claire's mm-hmm. family, and I'm kind of eager to hear back from them, see what they think. So I think the book kind of gives Claire a certain sort of permanence that, you know, I wouldn't mind having if you know, I had been written about. And I think it captures a little bit of her, captures a lot of her humor and her irony and her seriousness. And so I think that's a really good thing. And I hope that, you know, the readers, especially the people that knew Claire, that know Claire, can kind of see that. And you know, that it contributes something to them in their friendship with Claire that they hadn't had before.
You clearly have done a lot of healing. Life does go on, whether you feel like it should or not, after a terrible tragedy like this. Was writing this book a big part of healing for you?
You know, when I was doing the book, I resisted that therapy stuff. And I said, you know, this is nothing about healing. This is nothing to do with therapy. I just want to keep alive. I want to give form to this life that I really cherished with Claire, not only with Claire, but with our dog, Milo. I mean, it was really very, very vital part of our life together, of our family. So I needed to give form to it. But now that it's done, I've been able to move on, and I don't think that would have happened had I not written this book. So, yeah, I have to say, even though I resist, you know, that that sort of sentimental reading of writing a book about loss, I mean, and I think it is true. I've been able to move on, and you know, but with this with these memories.
Yeah.
I mean, these memories are very much alive in me now. And I'll be honest with you, I was very afraid of kind of forgetting. And, you know, I'm old enough now where you just can't rely on your memories anymore. And so as I was sort of reminiscing, I'm thinking, I've got to get this down before they're gone.
Yeah.
And I do think that's sort of ultimately the kind of the motivation for memoir writers, is they're working against the terrible nothingness of life. I mean, we're always, you know, life is framed by these things, by nothingness, by loss, by forgetting. And so you work desperately to keep at bay that terrible nothingness.
You are publishing this, and we only have about a minute left, but you're publishing this at a time of terrible, terrible loss, of course. And you mentioned that in your afterword, although at that point we had only lost 200,000 Americans,
yes,
to COVID-19. And of course, that number has climbed and climbed. And I'll tell you, Jeff, I had a hard time picking up this book because I thought, I don't know that I can take any more sadness right now. But it's also very comforting. I mean, it's heartbreaking, but there's a lot of comfort there. So thank you for sharing it. Do you feel like this is a book for our times?
I do. You know, I mean, I think the experience of writing the book was to kind of rekindle faith and at least in my own resilience. I mean, I was surprised by my resilience. I didn't expect that. You know, I mean, I'm a literary guy, and so I've read my Beckett and my Shakespeare, and when bad things happen to people, that's it. They're gone.
Yeah.
You know, they don't recover. And I think the writing this book, and Space Boy helped a lot too in that respect. It somehow sparked the resilience that was experienced through humor in the book. There's a lot of humor. And, you know, I look back at the things we did together, and I look back at our life, and I said, gosh, this is really funny.
And you know, did that it last. Well. You did it well.
Yeah.
Jeff,
okay.
Porter, thank you.
Thanks,
so
Charity.
Much. And I wish you a great deal of happiness in the future.
Well, thanks so much for talking and reading the book, and take care.
You too. Jeff Porter, he is the author of Planet Claire, Sweet for Cello and Sad-Eyed Lovers. It's a memoir of grief and a memoir that captures so much about his wife, Claire Sponsler, who passed away in 2016. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.